I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
There's a new film getting a lot of attention. It's about the artist Salvador Dali. It's not like a Cradle to Grave biopic or anything. I think the reason it's getting a lot of attention is it's because it's about this legendary artist thinking he's too legendary to die. And he's realizing he's getting old and coming to the end of his life. The film was made by another legend, the Canadian director Mary Harron. She'll be here to talk about it. That's coming up on Cue.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science where ever you get your podcasts.
He created this very strong persona, which is a bit of a caricature of himself, but, you know, with the mustache. Yeah. He created an image that was very, very marketable. And I think Andy Warhol learned everything from him.
Let me tell you who the he is there. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. The he is Salvador Dali, the legendary surrealist artist, the subject of a new movie that everyone's talking about right now called Dali Land. It's not your classic, like, artist biopic. It's not your, you know, from an early age, he picked up a paintbrush and all that stuff. It's about the later years of Salvador Dali, about his marriage, about his relationship with fame. And it's really about this great artist who feels he will never die, realizing that his life truly is coming to an end. Ben Kingsley plays Dali. He's really incredible. And the film is the latest film from Mary Harron, the award-winning director and screenwriter from Bracebridge, Ontario. You might know Mary's work like American Psycho or I Shot Andy Warhol. She was also a journalist for a while. She did one of the first ever interviews with the Sex Pistols. So no pressure on me. Dali Land had its world premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. And back then, I think it was September, yeah, I got to sit down with Mary and talk a little bit about Salvador Dali. Here's our conversation.
How are you?
I'm good. Lovely to be here.
So what is it about Dali that interested you?
Well, it was really, my husband wrote the screenplay and he persuaded me because at first I thought, well, I did a film by Andy Warhol. I don't want to do another film about an artist. But then he pointed out that two things. One is it could be a film about a marriage.
Yeah.
You know, and it was fun for us as a husband and wife, you know, to collaborate on a film about a marriage. A very different marriage to ours, very stormy and crazy marriage. But also that Dali is such a strange kind of extraterrestrial person.
Yeah.
You know, he's very hard to get a handle on.
Yeah.
As, you know, to get inside him. But as John pointed out, you know, one of the motivating things is it's an artist in the last years of his life, terrified of death and aging. And that's on the, you know, that's human. Anybody can relate to that. And the same with Gala, the two people who started out so close, in a way, their fear of death, they almost can't be around each other because they remind each other that they're old.
Yeah. That's such a lovely point. I mean, at the very beginning of the film, but I think maybe 10, 15 minutes in, Dali says something along the lines of like, I am sort of God. I don't think, I mean, it's not that God and I are comparable. I am very, very close to God. And then like 10 minutes later, he has to take his medication. You know, there is, you can watch this man really deal with his humanity in those moments.
And also he had a kind of Parkinson's, so his hand is, for a painter, I mean, he did manage to kind of still his hand while he was painting, but you can see his hand shaking and he drops a glass, you know, and his own physical sort of vulnerability is getting to him.
Speaking of Andy Warhol, there's a quote that Andy Warhol used to describe Salvador Dali that I've heard you were fond of. He said, quote, "He was both more old-fashioned than any of us and more advanced than any of us."
Yes, why more of the future, more of the past.
Why did that resonate with you so much?
Well, because it was true, because I think a lot of the times we think of him as the 1930s, you know, the great period of surrealism. But he kept working right, you know, up until about 4 or 5 years before he died. Actually, when his wife died, he basically died, even though he lived for 5 or 6 years after that, he stopped working. But he was doing holograms. He was fascinated with physics. He had all kinds of ideas about being an idea of being an artist, which people were very contemptuous of at the time, which was that I'm going to design furniture and I'll do commercials and I'll make jewelry and I'll have a sort of factory of art. And, you know, that's what, you know, Jeff Koons does, or Damien Hirst. You know, it's a very modern idea of being an artist. And people now have rediscovered and said, actually, no, he kept thinking the idea of what an artist is for the modern world. And, you know, you can – there are certainly things you can criticize in him. Yeah. There was – it's a sort of part of the film that Gala got him to sign endless sheets of blank paper – that were then used to print lithographs that often were just Xeroxes.
And that was originally going to be most of the conceit of the film. That was supposed to be a big part of the film at first, right?
That's the as the project was brought to us, it was more about art fraud. But in a way, there's not that much emotional, personal story that you can say about art fraud. Yes, it happened. And so it's part of the story, but it's emotionally or dramatically, I didn't want to make it the main story. I was more fascinated with is this, you know, what happens to a kind of great artist – And a legendary marriage in its last years when all's falling apart.
Yeah. Can you talk more about the marriage? Because I think even for me going into this, I was expecting a film about Salvador Dali. Mm. And I ended up watching a really beautiful film about two people, about Salvador Dali and Gala. Mm. Can you give people who are listening to this who maybe aren't as familiar with her, talk to me a little bit about her and them?
Yes. Well, Gala is in many ways presented as a great villain in art history. But she was Dali's muse. You know, he dedicated everything to her. He used to say, "My paintings are done with her blood," you know. And she devoted her life to him. She was a few years, like 12 years older. They met when he was in his early 20s. And so they were like art warriors. You know, she saw in him, she'd been the lover of everybody, by the way, all the famous, you know, she was married to someone else and she'd lived with Max, had a sort of menage a trois with Max Ernst. I mean, she had sort of slept with everybody and she was a great femme fatale. Anyway, she took up with Dali. They maybe... who knows? It's maybe sex a few times, but it was basically a sexless marriage. He was a voyeur, and she had like innumerable young lovers right up into her, you know, 70s and beyond. And so, but what bound them together was not sex; it was their shared belief in his art. But you know, and it was incredibly close. They were like one person for many years. And then when they came to America and he became a celebrity, people like ignored Gala. People didn't want to know. It wasn't Dali and Gala anymore. It was just Salvador Dali, the star. And I think she felt kind of bitter about that. And then he stopped painting so much and was doing things like holograms, which she didn't like. And she just like, be a great painter in the tradition of Velázquez. And so they just started to grow apart, but they were still so, I think what the film shows is they're still so bound up together.
Yeah.
Like I say, when she died, he was basically, that was the end of him.
It's funny you mentioned that when he comes to America, he becomes this celebrity because in the era in which the majority of this film takes place, which is in the 1970s, I was trying to figure out what exactly America thought about Dali at the time, because in some ways he was he was being respected as this great painter from the surrealist era, as you mentioned. Mm. He had also become a bit of a caricature of himself, a bit of a cartoon.
Yes.
So for people who don't know, talk to me a little bit about this era of Dali's life and how he was perceived in the New York art scene at the time, which was changing, right?
Yes. I mean, because, you know, he was the first artist to be on the cover of Time magazine. That was in like the early 30s. And then, you know, when in our period in the 70s, which is the bulk of the film, you know, he wasn't cool because it was the time of minimalism and conceptual art. And he was considered old-fashioned and also kind of a joke because he did these commercial things like he'd do an ad for a chocolate bar or something. And he also had created this very strong persona, which is a bit of a caricature of himself, but, you know, with the mustache. Yeah. He created an image that was very, very marketable. And I think Andy Warhol learned everything from him.
Really?
Yes. He learned how to create a persona. how to have a defining, you know, with Warhol it was the wig and with Deli it's the mustache. And then he learned how to, you know, don't be afraid of commercialization, you know, design furniture, you know, trademark things, you know, do a certain mass production. But at the same time, they're both great artists. You know, it's complicated with this late stage of modern art because I think what they both said is they weren't pretending like people felt much more reverence for Picasso, although Picasso did a lot of mass production too.
Yeah, yeah.
But Picasso was more clearly a painter and sculptor, fine artist. And Warhol and Dalí were much more unclassifiable. And they were more like we accept the modern world. We accept, you know, mechanization. We accept commercials. You know, I don't know. They embraced it in a way that the fine art world disapproved of.
They weren't going to let anybody else define who they were as artists, whether they be art purists or commercialization.
I think one thing about Dalí was he was a populist.
Yeah. Yeah.
He loved the great tradition of art, particularly of Spanish art, of Velázquez and El Greco and all that. But he also loved, like, he'd go into a Times Square gift store and buy some knickknack and say, I see beauty here.
Right.
So he saw beauty in things that other people might not see beauty in ordinary commercial things or mass-produced things. He could see beauty everywhere. And that, I think, is the thing that I most admire about him. He had no defining categories. Mm. He didn't think in terms of high and low. Mm. He just saw, what is this? Do I like it? Do I see beauty?
Weren't you in New York in the 70s, in the art scene around then too?
In sort of 75, you know, to say like 79, 78. And it was a fantastic time, maybe one of the greatest times of my life.
What were you doing there?
I had just left college and I was like, I don't know, working as a waitress and discovered the, you know, punk scene and CBGBs. It was very early on. But then I also had some uptown friends and I really remember going kind of being, living, you know, in the East Village, and then occasionally I'd go uptown, and then being invited to crazy parties. It was just an amazing time where doors opened for you because it was, you're young and it's an open time when people just invite you along for the ride.
And was he mentioned?
I mean, I was certainly aware of him.
He was around.
He was around. I was more aware of Warhol.
Yeah.
You know, but that was, at that point, Warhol was more like of an, a bit of an, but Warhol would come to CBGBs and stuff. I think I was aware of him, but not, you know, I think he was more like definitely an uptown world.
It's an interesting time to be talking to you here in Canada, because I know you grew up in Canada, you grew up in the UK, and I wanted to spend some time, just in the time we have left, talking a little bit about your career in film. Mm. Because I'm talking to a lot of first-time filmmakers this time around, people coming in with their first-ever feature films. How did the idea of making a film at all first come to you?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, there were no female film directors that I knew of, apart from Leni Riefenstahl. You know, I really had never heard of one until Lena Wertmüller, I think, was the first. And that was, I was in my 20s when I saw Swept Away. And so it just never occurred to me that I could be a director. But then I was a journalist, but then I had all these friends working at the BBC and in British television doing documentary. So the step from journalism to documentary is not so big. And I really wanted to do documentary. And I really wanted to do film. But the idea that I could make a film, I remember the first time somebody said to me, oh, well, if you're going to go into television, you should make films. And I thought, I was so embarrassed that anybody thought that I could make a film one day. It's like, no, of course I couldn't make films.
Why not?
I think because I thought of it as a very technical endeavor, and I'm not a very technical person.
Yeah.
But then, you know, as I was on a lot of shoots, and it took me ages to get the chance, 5 years to get the chance to direct, and then I realized, actually, you just have to know what you want. The director is the conductor of the orchestra, and everyone else has the expertise, and you have to control the tone and the picture and the overall sort of, you know, vision of it. And so then it was not, you know, then I thought, oh, yeah, I can do this.
Did the journalism part help you? Because I know I would know your work. Well, I know you did one of the early Sex Pistols interviews.
Yes.
Right? What year was that?
That was 76.
And they were still pretty.
Oh, yeah. No, that was the height. And there was like a half empty concert in Liverpool. And when I got backstage, Johnny Rotten said, oh, we haven't been interviewed by anybody from America before. And they were nice to me because I was for Punk Magazine, so I had my Punk Magazine T-shirt. And so I was not like from a big paper.
They were nice to you?
Yeah, they were because, you know, I think because I was from a fanzine and, you know. And
they got that. Well, yeah. My point being is I guess my question would be, through talking to, up to that point, talking to artists about their work, did it help you guide you when you found your way to your own work, creative work?
I mean, it might have. I mean, I'm sure it did. But it also gave me a lot of material because, for instance, I got the idea for our show, Andy Warhol. I had also written a lot about Warhol when I was a journalist and that I'd done the history of the Velvet Underground and done a lot of work on that world and interviewed everybody I could. But then I worked on a documentary about Warhol for the South Bank show. That's when the idea occurred to me about Valerie Solanas.
Yeah.
And then there were things that we – being a researcher and looking at a lot of different footage, a lot of things that I did in my films, early films, like mixing black and white and color, mixing different kinds of film stock, that's something that you do in documentary. And so it just seemed natural to me. There are certain stylistic things. I learned a bit like, oh, I like wide lenses. You know, there's things you just pick up.
Well, but it's interesting because you did develop such a style. I mean, you made films about Charles Manson, Valerie Solanas, as you mentioned, the woman who shot Andy Warhol. Of course, famously, you did American Psycho. It brought to mind – so we had Cronenberg in a little while ago. Uh-huh. But we had a great time asking about the various titles that the media have given him over the years. So we said to him, we said, like, how do you feel about Baron of Blood? And he, you know, and I said, how do you feel about – one of my favorites was the King of Venereal Horror, which is not what you want to be called at any point in your life. And we ended up doing that for you a little bit here.
Oh, okay.
And the one you get called the most is the Psychopath Auteur.
Oh, wow. I mean – I've only done – well, I mean, I suppose you could – if you called Valerie – I was going to say, well, I've just done American Psycho and Charles Manson were my psychopaths. But I guess you – in some ways, some people would say Valerie was. I would sort of think it was a little bit different. And then there's, you know, Alias Grace, jury's out on what Grace was exactly.
But is there something about these characters – I mean, I know this may be a bit of a stretch, but we were wondering whether – Dolly is related to these characters at all, whether you see any kind of continuation, or is this a bit of a deviation for you?
Well, you know, my husband wrote the script, and he originally did romantic comedy, so it's probably a somewhat warmer and gentler version of film than I normally do. I don't, you know, people have asked me, I have no idea why I make the films I do. What you're drawn to, it's like you just have to follow – you just have to be true to yourself about what – if you find it interesting, other people will find it interesting. You know, you can't fake it. You can't try and be someone you're not. And I don't know because I'm pretty, you know, sane person, I think. Yeah. I don't know.
Don't seem like a psychopath at all. I'm not worried for my safety.
No, I hope not. We'll just hold on there. but, I don't know. I think I am interested in psychological extremes. And people in extreme states. That's all I can say.
Does it, when you look at a Dolly painting now after making this film, does it change the way you look at it, knowing that, you know, after spending some time exploring the human behind them?
Oh, yeah, completely. I think also because his works are full of symbols and he reused, like any kind of great artist, the same things crop up and you think, oh, that's crutches. You know, oh, I read his autobiography and that has from that. At incidents, you know, you can just kind of interpret it, and which is one of the pleasures of studying somebody's work.
Mary, thank you for being here.
Oh, it was lovely. Thank you.
That was Mary Harron, the award-winning Canadian filmmaker. Her latest film, Dolly Land, will be in cinemas across the country from June 9th. It's also available to rent or buy digitally on June 9th as well. You can catch a screening of Dolly Land this Saturday, June 3rd, at the Blue Mountain Film Festival in Ontario's Blue Mountains. You can check the film festival listings for details. Next week, you can hear my conversation with Sir Ben Kingsley, the Oscar-winning actor. Sir Ben plays Salvador Dali in the film. If you've been listening to Q recently, you probably recognize this music you're listening to as our theme music. Just take a listen. But it's not some track we commissioned for the show. It's actually a song by a band from Montreal called By Perula. A song with singing, verses, and a chorus. And it's great. Just take a listen. Seeing as how that's the song that like is present in my work dreams, my work stress dreams, it is strange to hear lyrics to it. That's a bit of Still Got the Spirit, which, as I mentioned, is also the music we use for our theme here on Q. So By Perula are three dudes from different parts of the world who met in Montreal, and that's where Loïc Calatayud from the band joined me to talk about making their debut record One and the story behind the song that's become the soundtrack to our show. Take a listen. How are you? Thanks for being here.
Hey, how are you, Tom? I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having us.
For people who don't know the story, like we were hunting around for so long trying to find a theme, and we had like a Spotify list, like a playlist, I want to say of what, like 30, 40, 50, 60 Canadian songs, just trying our best to try to find something. And we tried a million songs and just nothing was clicking. And as soon as we heard Still Got the Spirit, we knew right away that it was the right song for us. So right off the bat, thank you so much for letting us use the song as the theme.
All right. Thank you so much for having the song in the show. It's so surreal to us. Like, it's amazing to be part of this show.
Oh, it's very cool for us too. I don't know that much about you guys. Like, how long have you guys been together as a band?
We started in 2020 and it was pretty fast. So we just met as new people and we became friends like really fast and starting to play together. Sergio had songs and we started to practice those songs. And in 4 days, we made like 4 songs and we were like, okay, we have to do something with it. We have to start a band together. And yeah, we sent the demos to Robbie Custer and it was like, I want to produce it. And it was on.
My understanding is you're all from kind of different places. Where did you all meet?
Yeah. We met in Montreal. I'm from Catalonia. Sergio's from Napoli. Seba's from Chile. And we had a French-Russian friend in common who invited us over to jam. It was like really surprising to find like your new best friend in a moment like that and like to share so much stuff we have in common from different cultures in another town with another culture. It was amazing.
That's beautiful to have that kind of moment where you realize everything's kind of gelling. Now, I tell you, I don't typically ask about the name of the band. Where does Bi-Parula come from?
Bi-Parula comes from Parula is a warbler.
Oh, like a bird.
Yeah, a bird. And we read an article about migratory birds, and this particular bird, who ornithologists don't know why, it comes from North America to South America, and it doesn't go over the land, but it goes straight to the ocean and fly over the ocean the whole way. And we were like, okay, that's like us. And
oh, that's beautiful. It's like you. It's like you all have traveled over the ocean to be together.
Yeah, so this made sense to have this band name.
Before we play the song, there's a story I heard that like something like you went in to do a recording session. You had met this producer who you had mentioned, and he makes you like sing your lyrics in front of some poet friend of his.
He made the poet read it. And so he gave me like advice about it. And at first it was like for some songs, it was not good. Like it was like, you're going all over the place with the lyrics. Like you can be simple. And I needed that. I wanted to overcomplexify it. And it was like, poetry is not that. Poetry is like being simple, going to the emotion. And it helped me a lot, like a lot.
So on that, we're going to play Still Got the Spirit, which is, I'm so grateful that we're able to share it, like, you know, as our theme song on the show. But I realize I have no idea what the song is about. What's the song about? Where did it come from?
We started to play that song with no lyrics. And then we focused on the chorus. And the idea behind the chorus was like a mix between Disorder from Joy Division, the ending of the song, like I got the spirit but lose the feeling, because it was like a deep moment for the three of us. I was just after a big breakup in the pandemics, no family, no friends. I lost a friend to cancer, and it was like, I'm so sad right now. But the other part of the song was like the quote from Albert Camus: in the midst of winter, I found there was within me an invincible summer, that was trying to put that in a song. Like, okay, I'm sad, but there's something inside me that will make me go through it. And the verses are talks about like my teenage days as an anxious boy, like not being able to fit in wherever I was going, and just looking at it like I'm going back to my parents' bedroom and I'm looking at all this anxiety that was filled in and just letting it go. Like, this song is about that, you know. It was kind of nostalgic and sad, but we want it to be uplifting, like hopeful.
Oh, that's so lovely. Now, here's what I'd like to do before we go. I think all three of you are there, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
All three of you are there. Could you say, hi, I'm, like, say your names, and then someone say, we're By Parula, and this is our song, Still Got the Spirit. Can you do that for me?
Hi, I'm Sergio Di Santo from Naples, and play drum with the By Parula.
Hi, I'm Loic Calatrid from Perpignan, Catalonia.
Hi, I'm Sebastian from Linares, Chile, and I'm the guitar player of By Parula.
We are By Parula, and this is our song Still Got the Spirit on cue.
When you listen to that, you can see how, I mean, we looked through a lot, as I mentioned, we looked through a lot of songs to try and find the right one for the new theme, and you can see why we chose that one. By Parula with their song Still Got the Spirit. You might recognize that as our theme here on Cue. Before that, you heard my conversation with Loic Calatayud from the band. Their debut album, One, is out now. All right, that's it for this episode of Cue. The other episode up from us today is a conversation with the Canadian rapper Belly. Now, I don't know if we, especially as the CBC, talk about this enough. Belly is a Canadian rapper and songwriter who has co-written, by the way, with another Canadian, but has co-written the most streamed song in Spotify history, the song with the most listens. It's Blinding Lights by The Weeknd. We're going to talk a little bit about Belly's own music, about co-writing with The Weeknd, about, you know, all of this success. And at one point he says this might be one of the last albums he ever makes. All right, we'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.